This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Google gets hit with a big fine in Europe, but will that actually change the way it does business? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, July 18th. Good, as always, to have you with us. And we start today with Google and that $5 billion fine from antitrust regulators in the European Union for using its Android software to push out competition and making phone companies pre-install Google apps. The EU said this was anti-competitive. Marketplace tech host Molly Wood joins me to break it down. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Lizzie.
So what does this fine mean for Google and for other companies doing business in Europe?
Well, for Google, it kind of just means a big quarterly bill. I mean, obviously, Google can afford this. There was, however, also a $2.7 billion fine last year from the EU. So certainly, if multi-billion dollar fines keep piling up, it could start to be a concern. It could also be a concern for Google if it really, truly did have to decouple its Android phone operating system from its own apps, especially Chrome and the Google search engine, which of course drives most of its advertising revenue. That's the reason that this really matters. But in the short term, Google is not going to do that. Google is going to appeal this decision. The case could, of course, take years to eventually get resolved. Now, longer term, of course, negative impressions could pile up. U.S. regulators could also start to get interested in what Google is doing and potentially enacting some regulation of their own. That's less likely. We haven't seen U.S. regulators really want to do that. But, you know, sometimes a drip becomes a flood.
What's the consumer aspect in all this?
Well, interestingly, one of the complaints about what Google has done with Android or Alphabet has done with Android is that they've engaged in a practice that consumers actually don't mind or that can actually be a little bit good for consumers, which is to standardize the Android experience. One of the complaints about Android, because unlike Apple, Google doesn't make the phones. You know, they make one phone that hardly anybody buys. But if you buy a Samsung or an HTC or an LG phone, you might get a very different experience of Android. So what they do is they say you have to use all of our apps and you have to use our Play Store so that the apps that people download are more secure and so that search and browsing work the same on any phone. That's not a horrible experience for consumers. Although that was the argument that, let's say, Microsoft made in the 1990s when the Department of Justice came after them and said bundling these services is anti-competitive. You know, Apple does the same thing. They just don't have a big enough market share for it to be particularly monopolistic.
You know, we talked a bit about what this means for companies operating in Europe. What about companies in Europe or sort of the idea that these European regulations could hamper business? Could they?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when it comes to the sort of downstream effects, you may see companies start to operate differently, whether they are U.S.-based companies or companies in Europe. There's just fundamentally, though, and I think this is really important, a philosophical difference about building businesses in these two places. Europe has said for years, privacy is a human right in Europe, and that is the foundation of our regulatory framework. The U.S. just doesn't operate that way. And frankly, you could argue we don't mind when companies get this big. This is in some ways about Europe trying to pull up the drawbridge and say, we did not consent to these companies running rampant through our society, and we're going to do our best to slow it down.
Marketplace's Molly Wood. Thank you so much, Molly.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
We're going to stay with this story now and those competing philosophies Molly mentioned and the EU's regulatory role. What it allows and doesn't can influence companies even outside its borders. Just think of all those terms of service updates you probably got when the EU passed new internet privacy regulations. Marketplace's Jed Kim takes a look at what this all means.
Here's how Ian Murray sees the fine against Google. He's with the Libertarian Competitive Enterprise Institute.
This is an attempt by the EU to impose its own regulation on the rest of the world. This is, in many ways, a sort of regulatory imperialism.
That's because it's often cost prohibitive for tech companies to have different products for different countries. So they tend to play it safe by making the most restrictive policies the default for everyone. Why is it that Europe is setting the rules for American companies at all? Ellen Goodman teaches law at Rutgers.
There just hasn't been a lot of antitrust enforcement in the U.S., and so it's pretty much either the EU or nothing.
Goodman's not convinced this fine will have as wide-ranging consequences as the EU's recent move to protect user data. Companies scramble to comply with that, even in non-EU markets. She thinks it'd be relatively simple for Google to tweak the apps that come with phones sold in the EU. After all, hardware wouldn't change. But the Google fine could have broader influence. Andrew Gavel teaches law at Howard University.
We're certainly going to see some people here in the U.S. pointing to the European decision as an example of why the U.S. antitrust agencies need to become more aggressive themselves.
And with a lot of anger over recent cases like the Cambridge Analytica access to Facebook user data, public sentiment may be more against the tech giants. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, green, except for tech. Details when we do the numbers. There are a lot of legacies of the financial crisis. In Washington, one is a government agency generally known as the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is supposed to help Americans get treated fairly by financial companies. It was championed by Democrats, and President Trump's administration has taken a very different approach, including trying to rename it. Now the agency has a new potential head who will face Senate hearings tomorrow. The issue is, nominee Kathleen Kraninger doesn't exactly have a consumer finance resume. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Kathleen Kraninger has an extensive background in Homeland Security. She has no experience in consumer finance. Right now, Kraninger is at the Office of Management and Budget, helping oversee Homeland Security. Kraninger's track record at OMB has not impressed consumer advocates like Lisa Donner, head of Americans for Financial Reform.
There are some basic questions about the role that she's played in some management failures.
Kraninger helped oversee the chaotic separation of undocumented immigrants and their children and the federal government's response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Donner says Kraninger's lack of experience would be disastrous at the CFPB, but Alan Kaplinsky, a lawyer who represents banks, says Kraninger can rely on advisors at the CFPB while she learns the ropes. He's impressed with her government experience.
And that she would bring that experience to bear on her management of the CFPB.
Kaplinsky likes the way the CFPB's acting head, Mick Mulvaney, is running the agency, delaying some rules, dropping some investigations. He says Kraninger would follow Mulvaney's lead. Hyde Capital Markets Director Edwin Groshan says that's the point.
I think that this is somewhat of a chess game.
Groshan says the White House deliberately nominated someone who might not be approved by the Senate. If that happens, Mulvaney can stay at the CFPB until almost the end of 2019. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We learned today from the Commerce Department that the housing market may be slowing. Housing starts declined in June. Residential building permits also dropped. At the same time, there's a shortage of construction workers and it costs more to build a house. So what does all this data tell us about the housing market? Marketplace's Renata Stego reports.
A decade after the housing market tanked, demand for housing is now fairly strong. Unemployment's low and wages are slowly rising. Susan Wachter teaches real estate and finance at the University of Pennsylvania, and she says that in far-flung suburbs and more rural areas,
there's plenty of land, plenty of housing available.
But in urban centers where there's a concentration of young workers' right to buy housing, well, there's a problem.
The affordability factor has never been worse in terms of entry-level households.
That's because there just aren't enough homes. Robert Dietz is chief economist for the National Association of Home Builders. The group expects to build 900,000 single-family homes this year, but it estimates the demand for those homes is higher, more like 1.2 million. Dietz says rising material costs due to tariffs and an ongoing labor shortage make it hard to build.
There are limits on how fast the industry can expand.
Still, the National Association of Home Builders' latest survey shows builders' confidence remains strong. Chris Herbert with Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies says builders are looking into long-term solutions, such as apprenticeship programs to train workers and manufacturing technology that reduces material costs. But Herbert says, in the short term,
people who might want to make the transition to owning are going to have to wait longer to do that.
Which means they're going to be spending more time as renters while the housing market stays tight. I'm Renata Seiko for Marketplace.
We just mentioned the CFPB, which grew out of the financial crisis. How that crisis and the recession affected people's everyday lives is the subject of our year-long project called Divided Decade. As part of that, we've got a series of portraits called How We Changed. And for this next installment, we hear from Jane Pock in St. Louis, Missouri.
At the time that the financial crisis started, I had been working at Washington Mutual as a wholesale account executive in their subprime division. The culture of the company was amazing. You felt that everybody wanted to accomplish the same end goal. You know, you want to help people achieve the American dream of homeownership. It was like no other place that I've ever worked. You know, even to the point where now, 10 years later, there's still a Facebook group of people that are WAMU employees. I was at Walgreens one evening after work, getting a prescription filled, and my cell phone rings. A coworker of mine was watching CNN, and they had a story about our division being dissolved. It was shocking. Every morning you would turn on the news and hear stories about subprime mortgage lenders and how they're the scourge of society and they're ruining the economy. And it was gut-wrenching. Every industry has greed in it, and I understand that there was a lot of it in that industry, but it didn't mean that everybody that was in it wasn't truly trying to do their best. You know, we did good ethical business. It took me a long time to watch the movie Too Big to Fail without shaking, just visibly shaking. Because I was so angry. I was disappointed that if banks were going to be rescued, that it wasn't the one that I worked for. I was disappointed that I felt like WAMU went to Chase in an overnight fire sale. But ultimately, I agree with what was done. I just wish I would have been one of the chosen ones. I did not think that my life could change as drastically as it did. It opened my eyes is how it changed me, I guess.
You can see a photo of Jane Pock on Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. And you can let us know how the financial crisis changed you with the hashtag #HowWeChanged. Coming up,
it looks like tap and jazz and ballet and modern and hip-hop all at once.
We'll take you to where the skies dance. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 79 points, 0.3% to close at 25,199. The NASDAQ declined less than a point, essentially flat, to finish at 7,854. And the S&P 500 was up 6 points, 0.2% to end at 2,815. We looked at the EU's decision to fine Google for anti-competitive behavior around its Android mobile operating system, so a look at Google's parent company, Alphabet. It remained pretty much unchanged. But investors took a bite out of Apple, down 0.5%. Chinese multinational e-commerce company Alibaba slumped 0.9%. Fast food giant McDonald's and coffee chain Starbucks say they're teaming up to develop a cup made from recyclable materials. McDonald's poured down 0.1%. Starbucks lost 0.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.87%. You're listening to Marketplace.
I'm Shepard from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I listen to Marketplace several times, actually, every day, because it's got the economic news and developments that are important to me. I donate to Marketplace so that it can be available to everyone, and I hope you'll join me in this effort. Thanks.
To join Shepard as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. And maybe the place where you live has banned plastic straws, or is considering it because of their environmental impact. But this next segment is less about the merits of a straw ban and more, well, a story about how straws and their use mirror American capitalism. Alexis Madrigal wrote it for The Atlantic and started with how straws first came to mass use as a tool to improve hygiene.
I mean, there was this tradition, you know, we have water fountains, so we've sort of forgotten about this, but there used to be a thing called a common cup. And a common cup was like at a factory, there'd just be some water, there was a cup on a chain, and you'd just go dip the cup and drink it, right? This was kind of the state of hygiene. There were diseases, obviously, that were waterborne. And so many different kinds of reformers, a lot of women actually get together and start like campaigning around hygiene and cleaning up how things are going. And it kind of intersects with another kind of interesting technological story, which is you basically get soda water, and this ends up going into soda fountains, which become the women's alternative to the saloon. And like the straw was there.
Well, what was the birth of the straw as a consumer product?
The straw, as we know it, sort of starts as basically a stalk of grass, of rye grass, which were cut by farmers into a specific size and then delivered into cities. And so as a product, the way that this really gets going is there was a guy named M.C. Stone, who was in Washington, D.C., and he creates the patent for the artificial straw. And that basically is paper wrapped around a kind of cylindrical form and then sealed in some way, oftentimes with like a kind of wax.
Yeah. And what era are we talking about?
This is like 1880s.
I'm going to fast forward a bit to the era of the birth of the suburbs and to the sort of post-war era and the role of McDonald's in taking the straw from post-industrial revolution to mass consumerism. Where does McDonald's fit in?
So, little known fact, perhaps, about Ray Kroc, who kind of built the McDonald's empire. He worked for the Lilly Tulip Cup Corporation, which made paper cups as well as straws. And he worked for them for 16 years. That took him across the whole Midwest, familiarized himself with the country and how to sell. He calls paper cups innovative and upbeat. And he says, I sensed from the outset that paper cups were part of the way America was headed. But what he's talking about is a kind of disposable economy, right? A place where you can just stop on the side of the road, eat a hamburger and like, you know, throw the disposable, you know, container over your shoulder and get on your way.
You use straws in some ways in this piece as sort of like a metaphor for the American worker and the state of the American economy. Where are we now, would you say, in that growth process, now that we're sort of talking about banning plastic straws?
You know, people are trying to recover something about an America that doesn't feel as disposable, an America where, you know, there's a greater sense of the collective, a greater sense of this America we imagine that existed in the past. And I think what really strikes me about that, we're not looking to any like interesting future for the straw, right? And I think that's really indicative of the last like 5 or 10 years where company power has come to be seen more complicated and maybe problematic. But there's no real sense that that we know what the future looks like anymore, that, you know, we can pin it down in some interesting way.
I guess in that case, is the straw sort of a sideshow debate because we don't know how to have the other conversations?
I think it's just hard to confront the real sources of environmental degradation in the world, right? Because they're so intimately tied up with the way that at least pretty much every American lives. But maybe if we take this one basically insignificant thing, we can see the role that everything from individual innovation to private equity to the growth of sort of national chains played in sort of how everything works.
Alexis Madrigal is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Did you know that until the 1950s, the federal government told weather forecasters they couldn't use the word tornado? They worried that inaccurate storm predictions on inaccurate equipment would cause more panic than good. But technology evolved and tracking storms became a high-risk hobby for some people, like Roger Hill. He leads storm-chasing tours for amateurs. Marketplace's Peter Balanon-Rosen flew to the heart of Tornado Alley to join a tour and see how to make a business from predicting the unpredictable.
Actually, I soon learned there's no guarantee we'd see anything. It's not when we'll come across some violent act of nature, it's if we will.
That's kind of the fun in it, actually.
Roger Hill co-owns Silver Lining Tours. We meet in Oklahoma City before his third tour of the year.
I mean, we may start the day in Oklahoma City and then realize that we have to be in western Kansas or in the Texas Panhandle or eastern Colorado. I mean, it varies day to day.
It's basically looking at forecasts and going. Hill's like the Papa Bear of storm chasers, over 6 feet tall, with a warm smile and the Guinness World Record for most tornadoes ever seen. 630 as of December 2015, when he earned that title.
I always said when I hit 1,000 tornadoes that I would quit.
But for now, tourists pay about $3,000 each to join his tours.
Can I have everybody come over here?
17 guests gather for day one of this week-long tour. The idea is to head to northwest Nebraska for a potential thunderstorm.
All right, northbound we go. It'll be a long day. Hopefully we get something to look at.
The group, in three identical white vans, sets out. Now, this business has costs. About $250,000 each year for insurance, vehicle maintenance, fuel, hotels each night, plus advertising, a website, merch. About 700 miles, 13 hours, and a few potty breaks later, we're nearly to the Nebraska-South Dakota border. It's been blue skies all day. But then...
oh, there's some lightning.
We pull over. Deep, dark purple clouds roll and tumble, occasionally glowing pink as lightning flickers. A setting sun turns the horizon orange, like a blanket of fire separating prairie from storm. It's quiet. No one's shouting or jumping. People just take it in. Above, it looks like the sky's almost dancing.
It does. It looks like tap and jazz and ballet and modern and hip-hop all at once.
Laura Cohen lives in New Jersey. It's her third time doing a tour with Roger Hill, and it's these moments that keep her coming back. We watch lightning tear up the night sky from a few different places. Now, actually finding a storm, well, that's a process. The next day, sitting shotgun in a van, Roger Hill checks weather models on a computer, tries to figure out what the weather will do, and stay three moves ahead. It's like chess, but with weather.
You have storms that are forming up just to our east, but they're not very good storms.
Uh-oh.
Hill's not alone in this industry. Over a dozen competing companies offer tours. Hill knows this, too. He asks people not to tweet where we are. We turn onto a gravel road. He checks the radar.
Oh, my God, that's terrible looking. Oh, boy. There's nothing there.
The storm we're chasing? It fizzled.
Throwing in the towel, this is up north of the warm front.
But I guess that's part of the chase. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Hill remembers advice from an old boss.
If you can find a job that is your passion in life and make a living doing it, he said, do it. And I did.
Five more years, he says, then he'll retire. But for now, It's Life on the Road. I'm Peter Ballinon-Rosen for Marketplace.
This final note before we go today about the census. No, not the 2020 census of people, but the $1.5 million effort in Washington, D.C. to count cats. A bunch of different nonprofit groups are working together over 3 years to count the district's cat population in order to have a better understanding of exactly how many feral, outdoor, owned, and shelter cats are in the city. That, in turn, will inform both wildlife management and municipal policy. Hey, don't ever say Washington doesn't do anything. All right, that's it. We gotta go. Today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 79 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ dipped less than a point, basically flat. And the S&P 500 was up 6 points, 0.2%. Sarah Bouguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday engineer the program for us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and we'll see you all again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.